Thanks. So I want to talk about that. So my title is Searching for Spin Liquids with the MRG. And so I want to follow that because I'm not going to talk so much about understanding when you get a candidate spin liquid. Part of it is really identifying that it's a spin liquid of some sort, and you want to classify it. You'd really like to find the nature of its excitations. So that's a quite involved thing, but I'd like to talk about something that turns out to be a little bit simpler, which is to look through models and find out where you might have a spin liquid, how you can rule it out, and do that sort of quickly. So I'll talk first to give a little overview of our work on the KAG-MA, which is a Z2 spin liquid ground state, at least we think. Talk about efficiently calculating the phase diagrams, and how you deal with ordered regions, phase boundaries, and then the possible spin liquids. And then I'm going to give some fairly new results on the honeycomb J1, J2, and a surprising ground state, sort of the most interesting phase that we found, turned out not to be a spin liquid. It was an interesting phase in the XY honeycomb J1, J2. So my collaborators are my former student Simeng Yan. Zhenwei Zhu has done most of the work on the honeycomb models, almost all the work on the honeycomb models. Miles Studenmeier, my postdoc, is going to be here for his second postdoc next year, and David Hughes at Princeton. Okay, so quantum spin liquids, what are they? Well, I'm going to take as sort of the starting simple definition as just something with no broken symmetries. So if you have an anti-ferromagnet with definite magnetic moments, then often you find some sort of broken symmetry magnetic order. You may find, when you frustrate it, that it will tend to have some sort of translational broken symmetry, giving you a valence bond order. And I'll have lots of plots like these where the thickness of these sort of chemical bond-looking things is just proportional to S dot S on that bond, normally with an average subtracted out. Some of them will be in different colors for the opposite sign. And so a spin liquid doesn't have any of these broken symmetries. And so we'll look at those. And there will be several talks later on today that I think are going to talk more about identifying topological order and learning the details of spin liquid states like the KAG-MA. OK, so it's always fun to see movies. I've got a couple of movies here. First of all, if you haven't heard of the DMRG before, this won't help too much, but you can say that it's an energy minimization method over matrix product states. So it's naturally set up for one dimension. And for two dimensions, if there are generalizations of DMRG, like PEPS and MIRA, that can work directly in two dimensions. But I'm going to be talking about this sort of simpler, less natural way of just using an MPS that takes a path through the system, normally a cylinder, and treats it like a 1D system. And the problem with that is that because of the area law, this requires keeping a bond dimension that grows exponentially with the width of the system. So we can go out to a certain width, and then we're sort of hit a brick wall. So this movie is showing one of the calculations for the KAG-MA system. Is it starting over? OK, it's done the calculation. So you can see this little green dash thing flashing around. And so this is actually not, this was set up to be a difficult DMRG calculation for this size system. That normally when we do, when we make this translation to 1D, we just do it in as sort of minimal area fashion as possible to minimize the area of the cuts. But you can bias it in funny ways if you instead follow a funny path. And so if you have a particular valence bond crystal, you can try to follow that valence bond crystal. When you go through one part of the dimer, you go through the next part. And you can bias it rather heavily in favor of that valence bond crystal. And so when we were doing the KAG-MA, the preponderance of evidence when we started was that it was in the starting state of this system, which is the honeycomb valence bond crystal. And so in this calculation, it was starting in that state. It had a path that was heavily biased towards that state. And then the question was, could DMRG overcome the bias and still get this spin liquid state that we were seeing more easily in other calculations? And so what you see in the calculation is it starts out with this ordered state, and then as the calculation progresses, we have a matrix dimension that's shown here as M that's controlling the accuracy of the calculation. And that's slowly increasing as we go through the system. The sweeping is shown rather slowly when you can see the green dot, but it ramps up in speed as soon as that disappears. And so we have these sweeps, and then we can see the energy dropping. It's a variational energy, so we always know that we're above the exact energy for that particular system. And so what you see in this system as we progress is that the, and there's also pinning on the edges that also favors this state. And all of those biases in favor of this ordered state all go away. Every bond becomes exactly the same magnitude and energy as every other one. It's sort of the simple sign of a spin liquid.
Is that in real time?
Yes, just on the laptop.
How long would that take?
Let's see. The typical time is, say 2 days. You know, it's sort of a matter of patience. You set up if you can run it overnight, you do a bigger system, and so if you're impatient like me, then you just have a few runs that really last for weeks. And this is usually on. This was not done with a parallelized algorithm that I'll mention a little bit later. So these are sort of one node or one workstation calculations. Okay, so let me show you a little bit about looking at energies. So this is one way that you can sort of compare against other states to see which one is the right answer. So if you want to, and so this is an example of a set of tricks that we've developed over time, or techniques that, we have a basic algorithm, but then exactly how you use it strongly influences how well you can actually make conclusions. So for instance, we want the total energy of the system, and we don't have a completely periodic system. All of these systems are cylinders. This one is wrapped around with a shift as you go around. So you'll see some of these funny notations, like this one's YC104. Well, some of the bonds are in the Y direction. It's 10 wide, and there's a shift of 4 as you go across. So we tried to do as many of these different types of cylinders that were within the reach of our calculations. And so it has funny things that go on the ends, and we don't want to look at the energy of that. So this simple technique of doing a long system and then a shorter system with exactly the same boundary conditions, and then subtracting and dividing by the difference in the number of sites gives you a very nice estimate of the energy per site for this system. The sort of systematic errors from this subtraction that are sort of break the variationality of this are like of the order of 10 to the minus 5 per site. Okay, then we can also look at this as a function of the number of states we keep. And this can extrapolate very nicely with something that we measure in the calculation, the total truncation error. And so in this calculation, this shows the results with the subtraction. So each of these is a subtraction for that fixed number of states. And then it typically has a region that's not really asymptotic, but then it goes over to a regime where it's very linear, and you can extrapolate to a more accurate result. So this was a fairly big system, and so the extrapolation really gave us a meaningful contribution. But often we do most of the calculations stepping back a little bit so that the extrapolation is really not an important part of this. Okay, and then we have this comparison of energies. We sort of established that this is a bulk energy, at least for that width cylinder. Then we can look at these energies as a function of 1 over the cylinder width, compare with other approaches. And the main conclusion here was that the energy just became flat from the DMRG results once you went to wide enough cylinders. And going along with that was measurements of correlation lengths that were showing them to be quite short.
So Steve?
Yeah.
Okay. So can you tell us what total truncation error on the left plot, operationally, roughly, what is that?
Yeah, so what you do is at each step of the calculation, you have a Schmidt decomposition, and you throw away many of the Schmidt coefficients. And so you square them, take the probability associated that you've thrown away, and then you just add it up as you've gone along. Now, in certain circumstances, this is a rigorous measure of the error in the wave function. But here we're sort of searching for the ground state, so it's not completely rigorous. And so we didn't know to start with that it would extrapolate, that it would be such a consistent measure that it would extrapolate so well. But this is quite typical. It really does extrapolate quite well in the majority of cases.
But total truncation error is in one bond, or
this is sweep, or in one sweep all added together. Yeah, so the typical numbers are more like 10 to the minus 6.
But if you would have stopped at 2000, you could also have kind of made a pretty good linear fit.
Yeah, so. yeah, well, you know, you might have. I wouldn't. Okay, so in you not meaning you know. So making the case for the spin liquid, at this point, this was a very controversial subject. That, you know, there were lots of good calculations. You know, it turns out that this particular system was right near a phase boundary, so it made it particularly hard. And you can make the problem arbitrarily hard if you just pick one point and it happens to be right at a phase boundary. And so that's sort of what we had here. And so it was very hard, and so we had to work very hard to make the case in this system. Okay, but the one of the key messages today is just that you don't really need to work so hard in the vast majority of cases. You know, you have a phase diagram, and you don't have to do all this stuff to look at one point and say, that's not a spin liquid, or this might be a spin liquid. So instead, we can search for a whole phase diagram, say with two parameters, and find the key spin liquid candidates, identify the ordered phases, do a whole lot of interesting things in you know, a lot less work than what we had to do for just the Kagame, just looking at the ideal Kagame with no next nearest neighbor interaction. Once you find these cases, then you do have to be very careful. It's essential to look for all the possible types of correlations and sort of establish that they're short-ranged, or at least not giving you some order. Okay, so the key technique is doing long simulations where we vary a parameter of the system. And so even if we're just interested in the nearest neighbor Kagame, which is right here in this system, it's actually better to do this extended calculation. So what happens when you do this is, so that there's of course a gradient term which doesn't seem to have a huge influence for you know, distorting these diagrams. So mostly you have a region which has, say, some sort of broken symmetry, some sort of order, and then other regions, and you see in space these phase boundaries. And so in this case, we see the spin liquid, and we see that the spin liquid is extending over a broad range. And so there's a couple of things that happen. One is that the DMRG calculations, say in this region in the middle, or in the middle of the spin liquid, are much easier, much faster converging with the system size than they are near the phase boundaries. And they also tend to pin the behavior so that when you look near the boundary, it just knows that it has to put a boundary between these. If it goes critical at some particular point, it's not trying to do critical over an infinite range. It just is has it over a short distance. So it speeds up the calculation very nicely. Then you can zoom in by just doing the variation over a smaller range to look at these interesting regions, particularly with phase boundaries. Now, in this case, this was not a zoom in of the type that is really useful. This was just a bigger picture of the one above it. We can zoom in from, say, you know, right here to right here and try to identify the phases quite clearly. Okay. Yeah.
So
want to identify gapless edge states which represent the critical region, for example?
How do you find gapless edge states?
If you're at a critical point with your over a finite region, you presumably find some gapless kind of edge state that characterizes it.
So sometimes we find spinons or something on the boundaries. And then you can try to zoom in on that region, see if those spinons have to be there. Then we have to look at the width of the system and see how it depends on, we have to try to understand them in some detail, you know, hopefully with some analytical understanding of what might be going on there. So we certainly have to do that sometimes. Okay. So in this case for the Kagame, this at least we don't know how to get gaps as in this sort of one-shot deal. These were all separate detailed calculations that had to be done to get these gaps, which are they're specified by quantum numbers. So we either have within the SZ equals zero sector, we can look at different excited states. And so those, if they don't show up in the S equals one sector, then they'll be singlet states. And so we can look at these and look at these gaps. And you find here we are at J2 equals zero, the place that we worked so hard. We find that we're right near a phase boundary. We find that some of the early exact diagonalizations, because of finite size effects, had shifted the boundary and come to some conclusions that really apply to over here instead of over there. Okay, so anyway, if we now sit over here and look at the properties, we can have an easier time understanding this spin liquid and trying to identify what's going on. Okay, so you can do this for a whole two-dimensional phase diagram just by fixing, say, one of the parameters and varying along the other. So here's this some sort of schematic phase boundaries. And so we can set up these calculations to do each one, each sort of strip, and map the whole thing out. Each of these can be done separately. And in fact, you could imagine doing the whole phase diagram in one big, long calculation, just sort of by following this path and varying the parameters over the whole phase diagram. We haven't actually done this before, but I was listening to the talks yesterday and feeling black hole envy. We don't have any black holes in our calculation. And I thought, well, at least in principle, I could calculate a whole big phase diagram in one calculation. So for these long calculations, it's useful to use. Oh, yeah, go ahead.
Sorry, can I just ask, why is having this parameter vary along the length of the system better than doing many shorter systems?
You get a whole range of parameter, a whole range of variation in one shot. The whole calculation is more stable. If you do it otherwise, and some of the points will be easy, and some of them you'll sit on a phase boundary. You know, suppose your calculation, as you increase the accuracy of the calculation, it shifts the boundary a little bit, and you pick a point that's on one side, and then it shifts on the other side. And then all of a sudden, you're spending weeks trying to diagnose that point, as opposed to just, okay, you do this and you have some uncertainty in the location, which you can identify pretty well. And that's normally good enough.
Other situations which you could actually, in an experiment, have the parameters vary?
That's a good question. I mean, certainly cold atoms, you would think that you might be able to do this. Yeah. Okay, so you can do these long calculations in parallel with this nice method devised by Miles, and it's called parallel DMRG. And so in this movie, it shows four different nodes of a computer or four different workstations, each working on a little section of, it turns out this is a Heisenberg spin one chain. And so it's showing the energy on a bond, and the scale jumps a bit as you go along. So it's converging really nicely as you go along. But so each of these little workers goes back and forth When it bumps into the guy next to it, it exchanges some crucial information, and then it goes on and takes care of its little block. And so the speed up in this is almost ideally linear with the number of nodes that you have. And this is very nice because the previous sorts of approaches for parallelizing have always sort of maxed out at some sort of small speed up because they didn't distribute over the sites. This is the first one that sort of, well, there's some time evolution that does it over sites also. But the trick, it was a really simple trick that when you set up the matrix product state, you need to set it up with a certain sort of non-standard canonical form that allows you to work within each block with an orthogonal basis for everybody else. The singular value decomposition or density matrix diagonalization is only the proper truncation of your Hilbert space if it if the things you're working with in the matrix represent an orthogonal set of states. And so this ensures that you're working with an orthogonal set of states for each block, and then it allows this to work in a natural way. And you just have to exchange some information about Hamiltonian terms, pieces of a matrix product operator when the two...
Is that a real bottleneck in time when you do that exchange?
No, it's not too big a deal. But again, this is not actual real time. Okay, so let me now talk a little bit about a non-Kagame system, this honeycomb J1, J2 system. This is work that recently appeared in PRL. This is almost all of the work has been done by my students anyway. And so we have these various possible phases that have our potential have been proposed for this system. And the ones that we want to pay attention to are this plaquette valence bond crystal, which, you know, you think of valence bond crystals usually as strong dimers, but when they're in a hexagon, they may just fluctuate so much that it's more natural to think of them in just in terms of a strong bonds on a hexagon, weak bonds elsewhere. Here is this staggered valence bond crystal. And then we also see Nael states and collinear states.
The first two are the same symmetry, pretty much the same state.
Yeah.
You don't agree?
No, I was just trying to, you know, reviewing this, trying to say, why do we call this columnar anyway? But I you know.
I mean, they're the same state. They, it's just you, one is the negative of the other.
Yeah. Okay. Well, yeah.
Well, the square and an R.
Uh-huh.
On the
okay.
The same
okay. Fine. Yeah, we should really be classifying these as, you know, we get these really nice pictures of what's going on that it looks like this, but we should really be paying more attention to the classification of symmetry. Okay, so here's the model, and previous studies had sort of consistent, it's clear that there's Nael order here. It extends for some way into the system. This phase, this boundary, was coming out different in various calculations. Over here, we have another magnetic phase. And then the key thing that we were focusing on was this potential spin liquid phase in the center. So lots of calculations agreed that there was no magnetic order here. But some of the calculations came up with spin liquid and some of them with this plaquette valence bond order. So our results, and some of them also found this. Many of them also found this. The one that we did find, which is the SVBC. Okay. So here's our results. We tried to pin down these phase boundaries fairly well, but we spent most of our time in the middle of this region trying to determine carefully whether it was really a spin liquid or whether it had this order. And so we don't find a robust order parameter here. What you'll see is a scaling that the correlation lengths associated with this are growing as we make the system bigger. And in fact, they're growing faster than linearly. Okay, so let me show you some of these results. Okay, so here is one of these runs that scans through a set of J2 values as we go through the system. There's pinning on the left that induces this anti-ferromagnetic order. You have to try these things and find out what they want if you don't know what they're doing. At the edges, if you pin this nicely, we took away the bonds here so you could see how the anti-ferromagnetic order was decaying through the system. Okay, so one of the things we want to do is characterize how the order parameter varies along this system. Then here we have the system, and in this calculation, you say, well, this might be a spin liquid. It's not a clear example of some broken symmetry. Then over here, we have this staggered valence bond crystal. And in this case, we've also plotted the next nearest neighbor bonds when they have become antiferromagnetic. And so they've actually become fairly strongly antiferromagnetic, and so that the near neighbor and next nearest neighbor sort of form these ladder-like structures over here. Okay, then below that, we zoom in, and then we're actually using a different cylinder orientation. So this is one of our Y cylinders, and this has bonds in the X direction. So we zoom in and look at this system again and try to determine what's going on. And so we can better determine the location of this phase boundary with this sort of thing. And so I'll show you a lot more details. But this is sort of a first pass. And so we find this interesting region that we need to look at more carefully. Okay, so first let's talk about the ordered regions where, say, you have a magnetic order. We have a nice technique for this, a trick that turns out in practice to work very nicely. It's also nicely justified in a case where the dispersion is linear. So the idea is that we take a system and we consider the effect of pinning this order on the edges, and they're all cylinders. And then we consider looking at different aspect ratios of the cylinders. This one is too tall. It's too tall because we always put strong pinning as possible on the edges. So then we look in the center to see the order parameter. This one's too tall. It's like the three bears. This one's too soft. This one's just right. So this one has too big an order parameter. This one looks more 1D. There's a too much decay in the center. So you can actually justify in like spin wave theory and a continuum approximation that there's a certain order, a certain aspect ratio that gets this with the minimal finite size effects. So here's one of the calculations with a near optimal aspect ratio. And so we're going to be looking in the center. We have strong pinning on the edges, and we just measure the order parameter in the center. And so that was along the point J2 equals 0.1. So here are, then we look at this as a function of the width of the system. And so here we have different widths. We see that they're all pretty close together, and the second two widest widths are actually quite close together. And seem to give quite nicely consistent results for the edge of the phase. And so we don't know, this seems to work maybe almost too well, but it's also seemed to work almost too well in some other systems also. A little bit after our preprint went on the web, Subir told us, you might have a deconfined quantum critical point here, which we hadn't paid enough attention to, but then we were scooped in a paper that came out shortly after where they had emphasized this point. And so we don't have any real results on this potentially very interesting point, but it's certainly worth looking at, but it may also be quite difficult to study the system. Okay, so this sort of simple analysis actually was just applied to the model and the calculation that started all this interest in the honeycomb systems, which was this Nature paper that looked at the Hubbard model on the honeycomb system with a value of U that put it just on the insulator side. And so the initial paper found a spin liquid, There was another paper that did even larger systems, said it wasn't. And some of the authors on the original paper have now applied this more efficient technique as compared to looking at correlation functions, and found that even if you don't do the very biggest sizes, you find that it seems to be clear that it's not a spin liquid.
Did they use Monte Carlo?
Yes, the same. It was all the same Monte Carlo methods. And this is an example of something where we can't approach those. This was a case where it didn't have a sign problem because it was the half-filled Hubbard model on a bipartite lattice. And so we are not able to compete in that arena on this calculation. Hubbard models are harder. They were doing up to 36 by 36. You know, we're not there yet.
But what do you mean by this approach? You mean this?
Yes, this pinning on the edge to find out what the ordered phase is doing and then looking in the center, rather than trying to track all the correlation functions. The correlation functions, if you have a small order parameter, the correlation function gives you a squared result that you're trying to look at in the tails of the system. And if you do this pinning, you do these tricks, then you're looking at an order parameter that's not squared, and it's just a more natural way to do it.
Can you explain why 1.7 is more efficient than the naive choice of 2? Is there some reason for this? A windy nature?
I didn't have any particular expectations for exactly the right aspect ratio. So we tried this first on the triangular lattice and on the square lattice as a benchmark, and we found in those cases that we found a particular parameter that seemed to be optimal numerically, and then we had calculations done by Sasha Chernyshev using analytic approaches that we're finding a very close by value. So that's just what comes out. We're not sure completely how universal it is for particularly, it seems to work pretty well even if you don't satisfy the criteria for the derivation, this linear dispersion. Yeah.
So you determine the ideal aspect ratio by looking at the energy per
microwave? So we did that in detail for a set of benchmark models. And then when we're at this stage, we try this aspect ratio, and then we can see if we're at, we can see if it's behaving like it's right at the right point. So if you shift off from this, you can see instead of curves on top of each other here, you can see them spread apart. So it's this aspect ratio that's giving these very small finite size effects that making these curves on top of each other. Okay, another nice trick, which is shown here, is using the entanglement entropy along one of these systems that varies the parameter. So we take a dividing line that's nicely set up so it doesn't intersect a column as much as possible, and so we take a dividing line like this. We calculate the entanglement entropy, and we do one calculation, but we just plot this as a function of the position along the length. Okay, and then this is shown here for a number of different width systems. You're not seeing any peaks there. You're seeing something with a bit bigger slope here. If you take the absolute value of the derivative, then you see a peak, which seems to be growing here. This seems to be a rather nice technique for identifying the phase boundary, somewhere just a little bit less than 0.36, and that's also been our experience in other cases, so this works pretty well. In this case, we're not getting a peak in the entropy itself. If it was a second-order transition, I think we would expect that, but it looks, at least from this, like it might be first order, but we don't know how robust that conclusion is.
People expect that you go to a transition, the derivative has a peak in the
transition. Well, okay, suppose that it was just a first order transition, so that you just went from one phase to another. Well, of course, it's going to be smeared out a little bit because of finite size effects, finite width. And so you would expect, maybe some entropy that just has a dip like that. So this result is essentially consistent with that. If instead you went through a second order phase transition, you'd expect diverging correlation lengths, bump in the entropy as you went through that region. So, you know, we should expect, you know, bumps around here instead of just this fall off.
Bump in the entanglement entropy?
Right. So in if a second, you know, the entanglement entropy has this extra log term for a 1D system if you're at a critical point. And so if we haven't given enough region, it's going to be built, you know, if we vary this slowly through this region, it's going to be building up this longer range entanglement. You expect that the entanglement to grow. And then we're just plotting it versus position. Over here, it's just in some ordered phase or something with short range order. And so it's got a small entanglement. So that's sort of what we would expect.
But you're not cutting the critical system, right?
The log is a function of the size of the. Right, right. So we don't necessarily. It's a question of how wide is this region, how long does it have to, you know, so I'm not trying to make strong conclusions on this. You know, we, in our paper, we didn't explicitly say, I'm just sort of saying what you might expect if you go through this slowly. Yeah.
If you took your cut, then you're cutting it half with a sort of critical thing along the dimension, and maybe you would see
it. Yeah.
But in a two-dimensional system, there's no logarithmic thing anyway. Yeah. So.
No, no, but I mean, I have some naive expectation that, like Duncan was saying, there should be some like critical nodes on the domain wall between the two phases, right? And the extra entanglement you're talking about is from those degrees, right?
Right.
The cut in the right. Region of that one.
Right. Phase. So we're not seeing any sign of that here.
So maybe it's a
it's possible. Okay. So let's look in the center of this region that was proposed to be a spin liquid, J2 equals 0.3. And so we have a few different orientations of cylinders. We have some different widths. And so this narrow one, well, you look at it and you plot it just with the bond strengths and it looks like a spin liquid. But if you do subtract off the average bond strength, all of a sudden you see this weak Plaquette valence bond order showing up here. And so then we want to look at this at different size systems. This is still fairly narrow. Here's two more. We have to make sure that this order is, you know, once we've sort of identified a possible order, we have to make sure that it fits with the boundary and the wrapping that we do. And so we're just looking here at things where it does fit. You know, so you're seeing this order appearing. You're seeing a larger system where it's getting larger. The order's getting larger. And finally, here's a couple more.
Do you have a plot where you have both this and the nail on the left?
You mean a long system? And no, we sort of, this is all with exactly one. These are all exactly a J2 equals 0.3. We're not varying it in this case. We're just looking at this system. We're pinning it on the edge to favor this. And we're sort of looking at what the order is doing in the center. We also look at the correlation. We look at the order as a function of the distance from the edge in order to get a correlation length. And then, you know, it may just break symmetry and produce a finite order. In this case, it didn't. So we had to work a little bit harder and try to get as nice a possible numerical estimate of the correlation length so that we could scale it with system size. So we constructed a complex order parameter that sort of automatically builds in the fact that, you know, you have three possible plaquettes that come in. And so we actually give them each a direction in the complex plane so that if they're all equal, they cancel out. And so this order parameter makes for fairly nice calculations of the decay away from the edge.
Is it a chiral state because it's an intrinsically complex combination?
Yeah, well, we might be able to see that, but we weren't finding it. If there's anything, it would be something that we couldn't really see. It could be some long length. Okay, so you look at these as a function of the distance from the cylinder edge, and you see these straight lines that give you on the log scale that give you an estimate of a correlation length. for a variety of cylinders here, and you see that they're sort of separating into different types of cylinders. So here's these correlation lengths then plotted as a function of the cylinder width or circumference. And we see puzzlingly some different behavior for the x-oriented cylinders versus the y-oriented cylinders. And so we don't understand that. There's obviously some finite size effects that we don't understand. But if we plot these and extract an exponent, this one looks pretty straight, but it's actually fit better with an exponent a little bit above 1. The x cylinders have something that's substantially above 1. So you know, there's the result. It seems clear that the most likely phase is some sort of Plaquette valence bond phase. Maybe it's critical, but it doesn't look like such a good candidate for the spin liquid. Okay.
I don't understand what it means that the correlation length seems to grow faster than the width.
Yeah. So if you thought of sort of simple-minded finite size scaling, then you would expect the width of the system to sort of determine the correlation length,
right,
at least in terms of the exponents.
But if it grows faster than that.
Yeah. So if it grows faster than that, you know, maybe that indicates that it's going towards a regime where it has a constant value. We don't understand it in detail. Yeah. Okay. Okay.
It could break the symmetry in the strip, the discrete symmetry.
Right. Right. So we haven't seen that it wants to break the symmetry. That would be the clearest sign. So this is a tough system.
Yeah, it's,
you know,
like you have,
yeah,
to have a,
it's an easy system over most of the phase, yeah, and then there's these few points that are tough.
Does this mean that we are not yet in the asymptotic? So is that what
it means? Well, just with a discrete, yeah, symmetry, you can break in one dimension. So he could have a width of, I don't know, 6, and you know, in the infinite one dimensional limit, you would actually have, you know, this PD, I mean, this Plaquette bond phase, Plaquette bond phase.
Right. So if it was a magnetic,
this correlation length could jump to infinity. Yeah, I mean,
right.
Diverge at some c.
Right. Okay. So let me just say quickly that we did look at the entanglement entropy intercept, this thing that I think we'll hear more about from Leon. It's showing a little bit of a signal that should make one cautious. Right, we're looking at this, we're seeing that there's some possible broken symmetry, but we're getting a fairly good intercept close to this magical log 2. So I think the lesson here is that you want to pay most attention first to these correlation lengths and order issues to see that you're getting a spin liquid there, and then you can look at this in terms of classification. Maybe Leon will have a different opinion, but that's...
Steve, in this case, you could identify an order parameter and look at its correlation length. But suppose I just know that this spin gap and entanglement copy intercept log 2, and I don't have an idea of what order it may be, then you're saying everything's up in the air?
Okay, well, I tend to think of it in terms of they're sort of a different energy scales. You sort of think of some sort of RG from, you know, maybe in temperature, maybe something else. And so at some energy scale, you have, you know, basically the formation of a dimer liquid. Okay, but then if there's some instability at a lower energy scale, you may get some sort of weak order. And so I think you might get this signal at the higher energy scale. And then you look at lower energy scales, maybe it goes away. I don't understand that fully. That's a sort of intuitive picture.
There's a point that one should consider, which is that it's not incompatible to have both order and logical order.
Right.
But you know, a lot of care needs to be taken in both respects.
Right, right. Okay, so... let me show now the most interesting state that we found, just briefly. at least surprising to us. So this, we were looking, and I didn't show, we looked at the XY system, which people have looked at before. There's some, there's a nice exactly solvable model in the in some XY honeycomb systems. And so we looked at the we looked at the whole phase diagram. We actually did this procedure of doing the strips. We looked at the whole phase diagram. I'm not going to show that here. It's not published, but here's a really interesting state that we found. So here we're looking at, we did a phase diagram, sorry, with J3, looking for interesting states in addition to J2. But here's still J3 equals zero, and we see one of these long sweeps, and we get this interesting thing, which has out-of-plane nail order. And this scales rather nicely with system size. I can tell you that the nail, the order parameter here is about 0.14. You know, it just converges. And so this is a system that has no Z pieces in the Hamiltonian at all. And so this is an interesting state because it's very, it's unexpected, at least if you think in terms of simple mean field theories. How do you, you know, the expectation value of the Hamiltonian and the mean field theory when you're pointing in the wrong direction, perpendicular, would just be zero.
So does it also have X-ray order?
No.
You have checked that.
Yeah.
Because that would be like a super solid.
Right. No signs, no signs of super solid behavior at you know, that we tried to check here, yeah. No, so far no signs of super solid behavior. So you can think about this in the hardcore boson representation. Then it looks a little bit more natural because the out of plane order is then a CDW. But there's no near, you know, density terms in the Hamiltonian, which you would normally expect to drive a CDW. So somehow, just by the hardcore constraint and frustrated sorts of hopping, it can drive this this funny order. Okay. So conclusions. So with DMRG, we, you know, the sort of tricks keep improving. So we're now able to sort of search through phase diagrams pretty quickly to spot the interesting regions, and we have different techniques that we use for each part of the phase diagram. Some parts of the phase diagram are still very difficult to understand, and so some of them are still just beyond the reach of DMRG, but many parts we can access. And so in our search so far in these honeycomb models, varying J1, J2, and J3, the only sort of clear case for a spin liquid I left out here is not there, you know, so we sort of have the Kagame still as the key case. And we have this J1, J2 model in this interesting central J2 phase. We have this PVV order, and then we have this surprising state on the honeycomb XY J1, J2 model. Okay, thanks.
Thanks for this great talk. First of all, I would like to say, so the picture that we drew, they resemble a lot of what Asher did in the beginning of his career, all these kind of honeycombs that change. Uh-huh. And just to give you hope, when he proceeded in his life, at the end of his life, he started drawing Asher pictures like that in an ABS kind of method.
Oh, good.
So please, other questions?
So in point number two in your conclusion, yeah, the only definite case we have found with J1, J2, J3, does this include the square lattice?
So Zenway is very well trained now. I set him loose on these things. He's fairly skeptical about the J1, J2. We haven't made that a project and really pushed on it. But so there's certainly some doubt there. You know, so it may be some growing columnar correlation lengths there.
In the previous paper, this antiferromagnetic
order. Uh-huh.
So, what is the length over which the X-ray order spills over? Because I suspect that the out-of-plane real order may have a very weak X-ray order. Because if you follow from the left, you have a good X-ray order. It should spill over, like approximately. So I think maybe some more careful study needed to eliminate that possibility.
Right.
That would be very interesting. It would be really like a super solid.
Yeah, we certainly hoped for that. So far, we've been disappointed.
But the landscape already takes care of advantages.
Right.
How large is that landscape?
Right. So you can sit here. You know, you just use these scanning things for certain, you know, initial calculations, and then once we identify this region, we sit there, and we try to look at the behavior, and we look at pinning at different edges. So anyways, tried, you know, a variety of types of pinning directions on the edges to try to see if we got some sort of super solid. So nothing clear at this point. Nothing, no identifiable signs. Yeah.
That exponent scaling and the correlation line, looks pretty convincing, but assuming you have only 3 points, how will that actually constrain to that? What's your delta?
Yeah, that's a good question.
I mean, it'd almost be linear.
Yeah, and so in the paper, we eventually decided to scrap this more detailed plot with all the fits and draw, you know, a linear curve saying all the points were above it. That's another type of argument you can make that, you know, is sort of less conducive to worries like that. So that's what we eventually put in the paper. This was sort of an earlier version. Yes.
Can you comment on what, in the search for the spin in the 20-column validation model, what made you pick specifically the value J2 is 0.3? And would you expect that that's, you know, that there might be or might not be other values of J2?
Let's see. Let me find these guys. So there we are. So we'd like to sit. So we identify these ordered phases and phase boundaries. We try to pin them down as well as we can. You know, the order is fading here. So that takes, you know, we develop these techniques. But then we get the boundaries. And then usually we try to sit more or less in the middle.
And there would be no evidence for any kind of, I mean, you could imagine, for example, that there is a spin liquid phase, but it's very small.
Well, so then if we looked at the order parameter, so it's possible something happens. It might have to have some weird behavior around there. It, you know, might be unlikely that it could not show some signs in these. You know, it's not clear that that's a real possibility. Yeah.
Speaking to these ones again, do you ever find that the boundaries shift with the cylinder length in a study of the sort?
Right. They do shift a little bit. I don't know if I have any results. It's fairly small and sort of at the scale of what we're interested in here, you know, the phase boundaries, you know, if it shifts from 0.26 to 0.27, it's not of great interest. Okay.
Okay, so let's thank Steve again.